give it a shot. You will not regret it. Does that make sense? There's like light on just you two guys. I feel bad. Sorry. If I could change it, I would. I'm hitting my wall. I'm in the middle of a fast, or a day-long fast. There's a group called, their acronym is STAND, the Student Anti-Genocide Coalition, that is doing a fast for Darfur that they asked me to join. And I said, sure. And this is my first day-long fast, and it's killing me. It really is. Like, I'm dizzy and zoning out, and I had to have a little bit of coffee just to make sure that I could speak. I don't know how badly that violates the fast, but that's all I've had. But if anybody, I do check out this group. They're actually doing good things. Are there sort of Darfur projects here on campus or protests, that kind of thing? Crickets. You don't have to yell out. I'm sorry to put you on the spot, but I have been involved with Sudanese issues for years now. Ever since I got a letter in the mail back in 2002 from a woman named Mary Williams, who had started an organization called the Lost Boys Foundation, and they were formed in Atlanta to help Sudanese refugees, mostly young men, who had been resettled in the U.S. after spending 10 years in the Kakuma refugee camp in Kenya. They were helping them resettle, deal with issues in their new lives in Atlanta, help get jobs, help get into college, that sort of a thing. And so Mary contacted me and asked me if I wanted to get involved in some way, or maybe could I come out to Atlanta and help one of the guys that she was working with, named Valentino, write his biography or his autobiography. He wasn't sure how he was going to do it yet. So I went out to Atlanta in January of 2003 for the celebration of their birthday. And the Lost Boys, how many people here have heard of the Lost Boys of Sudan? Oh, okay, most people. This is a group of, at first, you know, almost 4,000 young men, mostly, almost overwhelmingly young men, who were resettled from Kakuma all at once by the U.S. government and placed in different cities around the country. And in Atlanta, there were about 180 of these guys. And so Mary was holding a birthday party for all of them and asked me to come. And it was held on January 11th. And the birthday party was held on the 11th because they'd been trying to do it on the 1st for a few years. And nobody would come. It was, you know, New Year's or whatever. But none of these guys, or very few of them, knew their actual birth date, because those sorts of records aren't kept usually in southern Sudan. And they certainly weren't kept with, most of these young men weren't in touch with their families, and many of whose families, you know, they had been killed or displaced during the Civil War. So the UN, when they had first been processed as refugees, first in Ethiopia and then in Kenya, the UN gave them birthdays arbitrarily. They all got the birthday of January 1st. So they would all celebrate it together every year in Atlanta, which is a strange thing. And but I went there and I met a lot of these guys, and I met Valentino, and we started working almost immediately that weekend on recording his life story. And when you don't eat, you get like dry mouth. That's one problem with fasting. There's probably others associated with fasting. I was like, at the last minute, I looked on a website, like I just typed in how to fast. And I got some, you know, like a Christian website about fasting and it was mostly didn't have a whole lot of scientific information, unfortunately. So Valentino and I started working on this book, and it started with, you know, dozens and dozens of hours of interviews, and then we worked on it on and off, on and off together, but always I've been thinking about it, and it's been the sole preoccupying thing in my creative life, I guess, for the last three and a half years. And most of that time, I was putting it together and trying to translate his life into something that would be engaging and would communicate what the people of Southern Sudan have been through over the last 20 years. Civil war in that part of the country covered 1983 to more or less 2003, 2004. There was a peace agreement between the rebel group there and the government. It was signed in 2005. But and a lot of the time was just trying to figure out exactly how best to tell his story. I'm going to go through a little bit about this and show you some more slides just so you can get an idea. There's a map of Sudan. You can see we've probably seen pictures and diagrams of Western Sudan, which is Darfur. You can see it sort of on the left. It's not labeled as such, but it's that left side there that's about the size of France. But Southern Sudan is where Valentino is from and where the 20-year civil war took place between more or less the south and the north. The government, Khartoum, is up there in the north, and they were fighting both the rebels, the SPLA, the Sudan People's Liberation Army, and decimating the villages from whence the rebels came, which is pretty much what they're doing in Darfur, to punish any rebel groups in the area. To catch a fish, they're drowning the pond. They're punishing everybody, all the villages, defenseless men, women, children, and burning these villages to the ground. This is just some pictures. You can get an idea of some of the landscape. This is Valentino here in L.A. With some of his lady friends. He got the name Valentino totally unrelated to his success with ladies, but it's apt enough. So this is, in 2003, we took a trip back to Sudan, actually, and this is when the war technically was still going on. There was sort of a tenuous ceasefire at the time, but we went to Nairobi first and basically waited and visited a lot of non-governmental organizations, NGOs, and aid organizations trying to get on a flight into Southern Sudan. There weren't any commercial flights, and there's no way to drive into Southern Sudan. There's no roads, really. So we were going to have to sort of basically bribe or sneak our way onto an aid flight, which is exactly what we did. And so we went back to his village, Mar el Bai, and the girl to his immediate left is a stepsister of his who he could barely remember. Valentino was about 6 when he left home. So I'm going to show some more pictures of the village. This is right when we got off the plane. Valentino was actually wearing my clothes because he was coming from Atlanta and his luggage went to Buffalo. And so he had no clothes, so we had to share my suitcase. But he's like he's just a clothes horse, sort of, you know, like in a way that I'm not. This is like the best I can do, and this is my author jacket. That I wear like once a year. But everything on Valentino, like when I look like a slob, everything you put him in, he looks fantastic. Anyway, but here we are in the village right when he got off and everybody's sort of becoming reacquainted with him because he was about the size of those boys there when he left and it was in the middle of the war and he was being chased by militias. Just like you know, you've heard about the Janjaweed that attack these villages in Darfur. At the time in the Civil War and the other incarnation of the civil war in southern Sudan, it was the Murhalin, which is pretty much the same militias that are given arms and license to attack and pillage and loot these villages. So I'm showing you these just to show. This is with a couple of his friends that he knew in Kakuma and have since moved back to southern Sudan. Here you, the two guys on the right here are workers for Save the Children, which is an organization it's a general aid organization that works in southern Sudan, but one of their major projects is reuniting former slaves and abductees. During the Civil War, a semi-dormant practice, where some of these militias would come into villages and take young men and women and bring them up north to serve as slaves, concubines, servants, was reenacted. And it was one of the, basically what's happening with the Janjaweed is the government says, do whatever you want, terrorize these villages, create chaos, punish them for their making any demands on our government for representation or sharing the oil wealth or anything else. And as payment, you can loot these villages and take whatever and whomever you want. So the two women on the left are actually former abductees. They were taken when they were 6 and 7 years old and made to be concubines and servants for members of the Sudanese government's army. And so they had been recently reunited maybe 6 months before, neither of whom speak Dinka, the local language. They both speak Arabic because that's what they learned when they were growing up there. And the woman on the left said very little. She had left a, she still was torn because she had left her two children that she had had by this man up north. And she was returned to her village, but she doesn't know that village and she doesn't know anybody there, and her children are north. So it's a very hard place to be for women in particular. So these are pictures of the Murahalin, which is, again, very similar to the Janjaweed. So if you can picture, I'm trying to show these pictures of like a village that's bustling, that's alive, that you see, you know, that they enjoy all the same things that we enjoy, you know, love and family and food and singing and dancing and you know, just life. And when we see images in the paper, you know, the New York Times will have pictures from Darfur, and it's always like this desolate landscape where you don't see anything, and the best we can see of the people is maybe a corpse, you know, off in the distance. I just want to show you what these villages are like, and they're actually very, you know, and then if you can picture these militias that come in and come and burn the villages to the ground and decimate the population. This is a hospital near Kakuma, the refugee camp. This is one of the victims. So I'll jump through there. This is Valentino with some of his friends in Atlanta. And those are my slides. I want to, did I explain what's going on enough? Does that make sense? You guys in the light? I'm going to read a little bit from this book. This book is called What is the What?, which is sort of it's a Sudanese creation myth or a legend that it's told in a lot of different areas of southern Sudan, where God created man, you know, and loved him and bestowed upon him gifts, and he said, you know, for my great gift to you, you can either have cattle, and if anybody, the Dinka cattle is like the main form of currency and status and everything. You can either have cattle, which will give you a livelihood and food and status and everything else, or you can have the what. And he didn't tell the man what the what is. He had to sort of, it was something that he would have to take on faith, like, well, behind door number one or behind door number two, that kind of thing. And it was sort of a test of faith and whatever else. And first man said, well, I'll take the cattle. And for thousands of years, this was seen as, like, obviously the best choice because the Dinka people thrived and considered themselves, you know, the greatest people on the planet, and it was only, you know, this more and more when the people when the Dinka people have suffered so mightily, especially in the last 20 years, they've questioned that decision. What is the what? And the assumption now, and in many of the stories, this is that the what was technology, were arms, were education, were all the things that the Arabs in the north had. And so it's sort of like a bitter question now to ask what is the what. And so that's where the title comes from. I'm going to read a short passage that takes place at the Kakuma refugee camp, where after the Lost Boys, as you know, probably thousands of them left their homes, fleeing the militias and the government army, and in some cases, recruitment by the rebel army, the SPLA. They made their way to Ethiopia, often with the help of the SPLA, and where they were, where they stayed in a refugee camp at Pinudo and other camps for about 2 years. And then when the regimes changed in Ethiopia, they were driven back into Sudan for upwards of a year. And then finally they were resettled in Kakuma, where they spent about 10 years. So this takes place in 1994 in Kakuma. At this time, Valentino is living with a teacher from his home village named Gop Chal, who goes by Gop. And there's about 80,000 people at the camp. And I think the rest of this is self-explanatory. The announcement, and this is all in Valentino's voice, which, forgive me, I vowed I would not read from this in his voice is very much. And so most of the events, if we do readings, he's going to read these passages. But he is, I'm glad to say, just started his freshman year in college a few weeks ago. And so he couldn't make it here. So I'm going to be Valentino. The announcement of the census was made while Gop was waiting for the coming of his wife and daughters, and this complicated his peace of mind. Gop had sent for his wife and daughters, who were still in southern Sudan. To serve us, to feed us, the UNHCR and Kakuma's many aid groups needed to know how many refugees were at the camp. Thus, in 1994, they announced they would count us. It would only take a few days, they said. To the organizers, I am sure, it seemed a very simple, necessary, and uncontroversial directive, but for the Sudanese elders, it was anything but. What do you think they have planned? Gop Chal wondered aloud. I didn't know what he meant by this, but soon I understood what had him and the majority of the Sudanese elders greatly concerned. Some learned elders were reminded of the colonial era when Africans were made to bear badges of identification on their necks. Could this counting be a pretext of a new colonial period? Gop mused. It's very possible, probable even. I said nothing. At the same time, there were practical, less symbolic reasons to oppose the census, including the fact that many elders imagined that it would decrease, not increase, our rations. If they discovered there were fewer of us than had been assumed, the food donations from the rest of the world would drop, and most pressing and widespread, and the most pressing and widespread fear among young and old at Kakuma was that the census would be a way for the UN to kill us all. Though these fears were only exacerbated when the fences were erected. The UN workers had begun to assemble barriers 6 feet tall and arranged like hallways. The fences would ensure that we would all walk single file on our way to be counted, and thus counted only once. Even those among us, the younger Sudanese primarily, who were not so worried until then, became gravely concerned when the fences went up. It was a malevolent-looking thing, that maze of fencing, orange and opaque, and soon even the best educated among us bought into the suspicion that this was a plan to eliminate the Dinka. Most of the Sudanese my age had learned of the Holocaust and were convinced that this was a plan much like that had been used to eliminate the Jews in Germany and Poland. I was dubious of the growing paranoia, but Gop was a believer. As rational a man as he was, he had a long memory for injustices visited upon the people of Sudan. What isn't possible, boy? He demanded. See where we are? You tell me what isn't possible at this time in Africa. But I had no reason to distrust the UN. They had been feeding us at Kakuma for years. There was not enough food, no, but they were the ones providing for us, and thus it seemed nonsensical that they would kill us after all this time. Yes, he reasoned, but see, perhaps now the food has run out. The food is gone, there's no more money, and Khartoum has paid the UN to kill us. So the UN gets two things. They get to save food, and they are paid to get rid of us. But how will they get away with it, I asked. That's easy. They say that we caught a disease only the Dinka can get. There are always illnesses unique to certain people, and this is what will happen. They'll say that there was a Dinka plague and that all the Sudanese are dead. This is how they'll justify killing every last one of us. That's impossible, I said. Is it? He asked. Was Rwanda impossible? I still thought that Gop's theory was unreliable, but I also knew that I should not forget that there were a great number of people who would be very happy if the Dinka were dead. So for a few days, I did not make up my mind about the headcount. Meanwhile, public sentiment was solidifying against our participation, especially when it was revealed that the fingers of all those counted, after being counted, would be dipped in ink. Why the ink? Gop asked. I didn't know. The ink is a fail-safe measure to ensure the Sudanese will be exterminated, he said. I said nothing, and he elaborated. Surely if the UN did not kill us Dinka while in the lines, he theorized, they would kill us with this ink on the fingers. How could the ink be removed? It would, he thought, enter our bodies when we ate. This seems very much like what they did to the Jews, Gop said. Sorry, this is when the fasting is... Man, my mouth. That's when the cotton mouth, it's such a good metaphor. People spoke a lot about the Jews in those days, which was odd considering that a short time before, most of the boys I knew thought the Jews were an extinct race. Before we learned about the Holocaust in school, in church we had been taught rather crudely that the Jews had aided in the killing of Jesus Christ. In those teachings, it was never intimated that the Jews were a people still inhabiting the earth. We thought of them as mythological creatures who did not exist outside the stories of the Bible. The night before the census, the entire series of fences, almost a mile long, was torn down. No one took responsibility, but many were quietly satisfied. In the end, after countless meetings with the Kenyan leadership at the camp, the Sudanese elders were convinced that the headcount was legitimate and was needed to provide better services to the refugees. The fences were rebuilt and the census was conducted a few weeks later. But in a way, those who feared the census were correct in that nothing very good came from it. After the count, there was less food, fewer services, even the departure of a few smaller programs. When they were done counting, the population of Kakuma had decreased by 8,000 people in one day. How had the UNHCR miscounted our numbers before the census? The answer is called recycling. Recycling was popular at Kakuma and is favored at most refugee camps, and any refugee anywhere in the world is familiar with the concept, even if they have a different name for it. The essence of the idea is that one can leave the camp and re-enter as a different person, thus keeping his first ration card and getting another when he enters again under his new name. This means that the recycler can eat twice as much as he did before, or if he chooses to trade the extra rations, he can buy or otherwise obtain anything else he needs and is not being given by the UN, sugar, meat, vegetables. The trading resulting from extra ration cards provided the basis for a vast secondary economy at Kakuma and kept thousands of refugees from anemia and related illnesses. At any given time, the administrators of Kakuma thought they were feeding 8,000 more people than they actually were. No one felt guilty about this small numerical deception. The ration card economy made commerce possible, and the ability of different groups to manipulate and thrive within the system led soon enough to a sort of social hierarchy at Kakuma. At the top of the ladder as a group were the Sudanese because our sheer numbers dominated the camp. But on an individual basis, the Ethiopians were the top caste, a few thousand representatives of that country's middle class who were forced out with Manjusto. They lived in Kakuma 1 and owned a good portion of the prosperous businesses. Their rivals in trade were the Somalis and the Eritreans, who found a way to coexist with the Ethiopians, though their countrymen were at odds with each other at home. Meanwhile, there was tension between the Somalis and the Bantu, a long-suffering group that had been transplanted from another Kenyan camp, Dadaab. The Bantu had first been made slaves in Mozambique and in the 1800s migrated to Somalia, where they endured 200 years of persecution. They were not allowed to own land or given access to political representation of any kind. When civil war engulfed Somalia in the 1990s, their situation worsened as their farms and homes were raided, their men killed, and their women raped. They were eventually some 17,000 Bantu in Kakuma, and even then, Even there, they were not always safe, as their members brought resentment from many Sudanese who considered the camp theirs. Somewhere near the bottom of it all sat the unaccompanied minors, the lost boys. We had no money, no family, and little means to attain either. One step up from this low rung could be gained if one found his way into a family. Living with Gop Chawl had afforded me some status and a few privileges, but I knew that once Gop's family arrived, it would be difficult to spread the family's rations around, and the many items necessary with so many young girls in the home would mean that there needed to be more income in our home, and an extra ration card was the beginning of the flow of wealth. One of us will have to recycle once the girls get here, Gop said one day, and I knew this to be true. I received my own rations every week, and when his wife and daughters arrived, Gop would qualify for a family ration, but the rations for a family of five would be insufficient, and we knew that the prime time to recycle again would be immediately after the census, when there would be extra vigilance about how much food would be given. I will go, I said, and I was sure of it. I would go as soon as his wife and girls arrived, I announced. Gop pretended to be surprised by my offer, but I knew he expected this of me. Recycling was always done by the young men at Kakuma, and I wanted to prove my worth to the family, to earn their respect shortly after his family arrived. For the weeks that followed, Akorakor, that's Valentino's best friend, and I spent many nights lying outside my shelter, doing our homework in the crisp blue light of the moon, plotting my recycling trip. You'll need extra pants, Akorakor said. I had no idea why I would need extra pants, but Akorakor enlightened me. I would need pants because with the pants, I would get the goat. One pair of pants should do it, he surmised. I asked Akorakor why I needed a goat. You need a goat to get the shillings, he said. I begged him to start at the beginning. I needed the pants, he said, because when I left Kakuma, I would be traveling to Nurus in Sudan, and in Sudan, they cannot find the sort of new Chinese-made pants that were available in Kakuma town. If I were to bring such pants to Nurus, I could trade them for a goat. And I needed a goat because if I were to bring a healthy goat back to Kakuma, where goats are scarce, I would be able to sell the animal for 2,000 shillings or more. You might as well make some money while you're out there risking your life, he said. This is the first I had heard of the trip still being dangerous. Or rather, I knew that in the past, if one left Kakuma and traveled the roads to Locochogio and past Locochogio, there were bandits one might encounter, Turkana or Taposa bandits, and they would at best steal everything you had and at worst steal all you had and kill you afterward. I had thought that those dangers were in the past, but apparently not. Nevertheless, the plan continued to develop, and Gop joined in. You should bring more than one pair of pants, he said. Akorakor was eating with us, which he often did because Gop knew how to cook and Akorakor did not. More goods, more goats, Gop bellowed. You might as well really make it worthwhile since you're out there risking your life and all. And from then on, the plan expanded. I would bring with me two shirts, a pair of pants, and a blanket, all new or seemingly new. And with all this, I would be able to trade for at least three goats, which would bring 6,000 shillings in Kakuma town, an amount that would keep Gop's family in necessities, even luxuries like sugar and butter, for many months. The money, combined with the extra ration card, would make me a hero in the family, and I dreamed of impressing my soon-to-be sisters, who would all look up to me and call me uncle. I better cut out. We're after 9. That's a little bit of that book there. Thanks a lot.